Welcome to episode 22 of Old Stories, New Information. I'm your host, Brent Colley, and on today's episode, I'm joined once again by Tim Abbott. So, hey, Tim, welcome.
Hey, thank you, Brent.
So what are we talking about today, Tim?
It's an exciting one. We're talking about an African-American soldier from Litchfield who served all 8 years of the American Revolution, whose story really wasn't understood until I started looking into it. And it's even bigger than that one fact I gave you. It's about an entire forgotten community of African-Americans living in Litchfield County at that time.
Wow. So this is that individual that Bantam's American Legion Post 44 honored, Cash Africa?
Yes, Cash Africa. What a great name. And I wrote an article for the Journal of the American Revolution about him, showcasing the research I had done. That ran, I believe, in March, and that, I think, is what prompted our good friends at the Post to choose him as their Soldier of the Month.
So who is he, and why is his story so significant?
You know, I hadn't known a thing about him until I was helping Litchfield plan for their 300th anniversary, and I was working with a group called the Litchfield Patriots. The Litchfield Patriots were interested in identifying everybody who had a connection to that town who served in the war. So you could have been born there, you could have moved there afterwards, as long as you served. And Cash Africa's name was known. But it was, you know, it's an interesting thought, because there weren't a lot of African Americans in Litchfield County at that time. Litchfield in 1774 only had 15 male African Americans out of a population of almost 2,500 people. So not all of them are of military age. Four of them enlisted in the Continental Army, but Cash Africa served every year from 1775 to 1783, and that is highly unusual. So I started looking at him, and I realized that Connecticut had forgotten a year of his service because it wasn't in Connecticut. And so this gets kind of interesting. He started out in 1775 in May, so right at the beginning of the war, enlisting in a company that was part of General Worcester's, at that time a colonel, Colonel Worcester's 1st Regiment, and they went up to Canada. And if you remember that period of the war, they eventually, under General Montgomery, pushed up toward Montreal, had a siege of Fort St. John, captured Montreal, and then all the Connecticut guys came home because their contracts were up. Many of them came home before that because they all had disease, but Cash stayed. He was one of the last to leave. And as soon as he got home, he reenlisted again, but in what's now Warren, but what was then East Kent. There was a company being formed by Eliezer Curtis, who's buried up there in the cemetery in Warren, and it was for Continental service for a regiment to be named later. Since they had no Connecticut troops up supporting the invasion of Canada, they needed more. So he came back, and he raised a bunch of guys from Litchfield and from Kent. Cash Africa was one of these. They marched back to the north, and they were eventually joined to a New York Continental Regiment under Goose Van Schoik. And so that part Connecticut forgot about, but New York remembered. So by comparing New York muster rolls with Connecticut muster rolls, it fills in a year, and an important year of his service. 1776, there were very few African Americans in the Continental Army because George Washington didn't want them, and neither did Congress. They didn't feel it was appropriate as a slaveholder. Washington was nervous about it, but the challenge of the war and getting enough manpower made them back away from that. But the folks who had already enlisted stayed, and Cash is one of those. He gets back after his year of service to Litchfield and immediately enlists for the duration of the war, however long that is, in the 5th Connecticut under Philip Burr Bradley. And he serves until the end of 1780 in that, and then when they reduce the number of Connecticut regiments that are needed, it becomes the 2nd Connecticut. That's under Heman Swift, whose house is in Cornwall Bridge. And in 1783, he finishes. So that's 8 years of service, which is remarkable.
Yeah, and also just the individuals that he served under, very significant generals.
Oh, absolutely. And part of some very interesting campaigns. If you follow the 5th Connecticut, they were recruiting in the spring of 1777. They marched down to reinforce Washington's army after the Battle of Brandywine and before Germantown. Cash didn't go at that time. He had business back in Litchfield. And this is one of the crazy parts of his story. He was an enslaved man. He had been enlisted, each of those enlistments, by somebody who enslaved him. But he proved that he had been falsely enslaved. He went to court. He got leave from the Army to prosecute a case against a widow named Deborah Marsh in Litchfield. Imagine that. And it went to court.
It proves that this guy was something special.
He had a vision of himself,
yeah,
right,
really
as a human
did.
Being and as someone who was worthy of the rights that he was entitled to at a time when a lot of people wouldn't have seen it that way.
But he had an angle because the Marsh family had the guy, Solomon Marsh, who was the captain up there in Litchfield.
That's right, Deborah's son,
help.
Solomon.
Yeah.
Solomon.
So the Danbury raid is going on. He's like, yeah, we're not going.
That's
and
right.
And so, because I think they were, I believe, they were loyalists.
They were loyalists. Many of them were. Solomon certainly was, and he was actually expelled from the Litchfield militia for not going to the Danbury raid and for being an obnoxious Tory. So, yes, he did have that advantage. He also had the advantage that he said he had been seized by force of arms and forced into slavery in September of 1774. The widow Marsh's husband had died the year before, so we can only speculate. But it is possible that had he been enslaved before that, he was meant to have been manumitted, and the widow didn't. But he proved it. And they not only did they give him his freedom, they gave him £100 cash as compensation and then sent him back to the Army because that one he couldn't get out of. So on he goes, Valley Forge. He survives that. He's at the Battle of Monmouth. And then he's back up in our area. He's at the Reading encampment, which I know is near and dear to your heart, the next year. And then he's stationed at Norwalk for a while, doing various things. In 1781, he's in the light infantry. And that's something else that's interesting. They were only picking sort of the best soldiers for that. They were the model troops. They were the shock troops. And he went with Lafayette to Virginia. He was at Yorktown. He was part of the front line attack led by Alexander Hamilton on a readout there, and he survived that.
Like I said, he was special. I mean, I love the fact that he was at Valley Forge down in Pennsylvania and then at the Connecticut Valley Forge in Reading. And, yeah, I mean, down in Norwalk, that's pretty much where all the alarms were, as it's close to the Long Island Sound, corridor. So
exactly.
It makes sense.
So this is all we knew about him, like if all we knew was here's an 8-year service member, African American, who was enlisted as an enslaved man and proved that he shouldn't have been, it would already be a fascinating and important story. But there's a lot more.
All right, so let's go after it.
I wanted to know what happened to him after the war. And his name pops up in a number of really interesting places for the next 12 to 15 years. One of the first things that one sees is there's an advertisement placed in the, I think it's called the Litchfield Ledger, the local newspaper, and this has just come to light, in 1785, advertising that he wants to go into service for someone, but as a paid person, as someone who knows cooking and can take care of a gentleman, and anyone who has inquiries about that should come down to the to the express office or to the printing office to find out more. So somebody, either he wrote it, but probably somebody helped him write it because it's very formal language. But he was basically hiring himself out as having qualifications suitable for taking care of, a gentleman who needed a valet or a cook, which is really interesting. The next thing he did was he placed an ad advertising for his wife who had run away from him. This is common, by the way. You probably remember this, too. Divorce in that era had several forms. It wasn't particularly common in the church. But if your wife left you and you were responsible legally for paying any debts she had, you could put an advertisement in the paper saying, my wife has absconded from my bed and board, and all people are on notice that I will not honor any debts she makes in my name. That was essentially a divorce. Very formulaic. He put that out there for his wife, Martha. the only knowledge we have of her is that advertisement. And the woodcut that was used showing a runaway wife was the standard woodcut of the era showing a white woman in a bonnet, because that's what they had at the printing office. Doesn't mean he was married to a white woman. It means that's what they had. So that's interesting, too. This is a guy who, you know, saw his rights as a male, being equal to that of any other husband whose wife leaves him. And so he did that. And then he still needed a job, and he had this relatively worthless paper he had gotten having left the Army with a promise of land out in the Western Reserve. He couldn't cash that in for its full value, so he sold it to Benjamin Talmadge. If you remember who that guy was, he was Washington's spy master.
I love Turn, as you know, the Netflix show. That's Washington spies.
Also a land speculator in a big way who had moved to Litchfield near the end of the war. And then Cash hired himself for a season in 1789 to work for Talmadge. He's the only free man working for Talmadge. Everybody else is enslaved. One of them a hired enslaved person, and the rest are Talmadge's enslaved people. But Cash is in charge of setting his own wages and his own terms of his labor because he's a free person. But the contract that he signed is at the Litchfield Historical Society, and it gives Talmadge the right to throw him out if he doesn't behave well. So there's still this sort of overarching paternal racism going on. But Cash is trying to navigate it the best he can. And then he remarries. And this is going to be fun for you because the other African-American community of any size at this point is over in Sharon. And it's formed after the war. If you know where Guinea Brook is that goes over to Route 4 and maybe Guinea Road.
Yeah, Route 4 just up from Cornwall Bridge.
Right. So that's Guinea West Africa. That's what it's named for. And it was settled by former African-American soldiers in the Continental Army. A guy named Robin Starr, who came up from Danbury, who was originally enslaved by the Starr family, but was given his freedom at some point, either during the war or at the end. A guy named Jeff Liberty and a bunch of others. And they settled on both sides of the river. So over, if you go to the Calhoun Cemetery down off of Route 7 and where the road comes down from Warren, there are a number of African-American gravestones sort of in the middle of it, but at the point which would have been the back of the cemetery at that time. The Starr family are represented there in multiple generations up through the Civil War, including soldiers who served in the 29th Connecticut Colored Volunteers. So it's a community that was sort of on the most marginal land, the most affordable land, on both sides of the river for at least three generations. And from that community, he met a woman named Anna Jackson, married her, and went back to Litchfield.
Yeah, no, it's quite a story. And you wonder what her connection is with the Jackson family as a whole, because, as you know, we have Jackson Hill and Jackson Road.
That's right.
So it's right there. And then the other thing, too, it came in another history project, but Caesar, just on the other way across the Housatonic on the Route 7 side, you know, so it was a black community that really no one knows much about.
You know, the more I've learned about Cash, the more it has highlighted the as you say, the forgotten or the ones that were not the focus of our normal passing on of stories, you know, communities in our area. We already know that the Native American history here, it's there if you pay attention. And it goes back a long time, but it tended to be romanticized and then shoved aside. Same with these guys. They were, by the 1870s, largely no longer living here for reasons of debt and better employment in cities and not being, you know, as welcome after the Civil War in this area at that time. And that, incidentally, is also something that happened to Cash earlier. By 1792, he's married. He's back in Litchfield. He's got a couple of small children, I think girls, based on what I'm going to tell you next. And then, like so many people, he can't support his family on what he can make as a day laborer in Litchfield. So he goes to New York City, and his family stays behind. And some folk in Litchfield, some white people in Litchfield, felt like he had abandoned his family. And one of them went down to New York looking for him. So imagine that a white man from Litchfield, a doctor, goes down to New York and walks the streets until he finds Cash Africa, who's working there for somebody else, and essentially accuses him of being a deadbeat. And he writes it down in his diary, which is why we know how this happened, that he had sort of tracked him down. He said, "You've abandoned your family. They're suffering." And according to the diary, Cash said, "I haven't done that. I have sent them some money by someone going to Litchfield, and I will make another provision for them." And then the diarist says, you know, as he does, he's very evasive, and I don't believe a word he says. He eventually said that he had sent some baize cloth back to his family for them to make petticoats for his girls, some bedgowns. So that means that's what he was able to send from his wages, and still he was being pestered by this guy from Litchfield. And so eventually they garnished his wages, and $5 a month started getting sent back with a receipt to Litchfield. That's where I lose Cash in 1796. So you were talking about what an extraordinary will he must have had. And yet I have to imagine, how did he feel after all of that? After all of that, being sort of tracked down by this sort of patronizing and sanctimonious white citizen of Litchfield, and basically being accused of being an irresponsible black man.
Yeah.
That stuff he could not overcome.
It was after all he had accomplished, it just ties to that timeline, that time frame. It was difficult for even a freed slave to travel anywhere outside of their community.
And in fact, there's a really sort of ugly long-term history of what were called black codes or black laws in the North, in Connecticut. During the 18th century, even a freed person of color couldn't travel the highways without a pass, couldn't be out after 9 at night. Like, there's a bunch of stuff there that sounds, to those of us who are used to thinking of slavery as being a Southern problem, it's a little eye-opening. And the more you look at that, the more you look at the fact that there was a significant, though small, African-American and, in fact, Native American presence in all of these communities in the 18th century, and they were governed by those kinds of prohibitions.
No, but I do love about the fact that these soldiers and these individuals are recognized is that Guinea Brook is now the permanent name. And
yes,
prior to that, it was Forge Creek.
Right.
So these individuals, even like you said, Cash is a great story, but also Robin Starr is too. I mean, he
yes.
Received a badge of merit, so these are all, people that basically helped us achieve our freedom, and, they're a part of our history.
They're a part of our history, and they were long-serving soldiers. If you remember in 77, I said that Cash enlisted for the duration of the war. Everything before that was short-term enlistments. It was common to enlist for a campaign for 6 months, like in 75 when the Connecticut guys went home when their contract was up, or in 76 for a year. But the Continental Army couldn't support itself that way, not with the British occupying New York, occupying Newport, eventually occupying Philadelphia. It needed to have long-term enlistments. And who's going to do that? The poor, the landless, the indentured, the apprentices, the eighth sons, the African Americans, the Native Americans, and the enslaved. That's the Continental Army. That's who the men are.
The thing is, when you talk to kids, is it wasn't like if the male of the family left, the women and the family members could just go to the store and get what they needed. When the male member left, he left with an important feature of the family, which got the meat, which was the musket. So people don't understand, and I think we're getting a better understanding in the present about why you had women and children come to the encampments was because of that. Unless they had family locally that could help them, their means left with the soldier.
You're right. That's a really important point, and it holds true for all of the enlisted men in the Continental Army, the sergeants and the corporals and the privates, that if they're the primary source of support for their family, they're not in the fields either. Like, it's not so much that you can't shoot meat. It's like you can't bring in any crops if there's nobody there to do that. Who's going to harvest the wheat? Who's going to tend the animals? It's going to be the younger kids, maybe. But the things that really required adult male labor, they're gone, or most of them are gone, which also explains desertions. Right? People who have enlisted for the war, at some point, you're going to want to get home, and sometimes you're furloughed to go home for a while, and maybe you take your time coming back. That's also true with Cash. He was given a 5-day furlough, and he took 3 months. But when he came back, they put him right back in the Army. That is dead common. That's not about cowardice. That's about, you know, survival. And that happened all the way through the war.
Yeah, well, stuff had to get done. I mean, that's just is the thing. Like, stuff had to get done. And so, you know, obviously, I've read your article. It's fantastic. And it's a part of what, a series of The Warriors?
Yes. The Journal of the American Revolution is a great online journal, and they print the best of their articles in a book every year. I'm kind of hoping this will be in the book next year. But if you go and look at it, you can find a tremendous amount of really well-researched new history on the period. This is the first of several articles that I have submitted to them on various topics, and I'm also writing a book.
You went down to D.C., and I was so jealous because you were like, you know, got the research and do all the stuff that I love to do. So,
I think it's
you're right.
Fun. It's as the reason we're doing these conversations, right, is because both of us are passionate about reconsidering or discovering anew stories about this region that may be a little different than the ones we had heard before, or maybe completely unfamiliar with the best available data and following where the data goes. I happen to be interested in the 18th century, so that's where I have been spending my time. But
no, it's necessary. I mean, there was a book about the encampments that one included Reading. I dropped that. But in there, you've got a lot of different information. But I think it's a product of all of the research in archaeology that's taken place, you know, basically from the 70s up to now.
You're right. The other thing that's completely changed it, and I really appreciate this as someone who's now researching something that's book length, the ability to search digital archives and find things without having to go and page through indices. An enormous amount of information is now available that wasn't during the bicentennial, unless you had a year to go and research a book. And so the stuff that you and I can start down the path on, just because if we know how to use the internet and we know how to search archives, we can find things, is tremendous. And because it's searchable, you can do queries that otherwise would have been impossible with just an index. If you just want to look up uniforms from the 1770s and who got what, you get it a lot faster now. But there's a catch. And the catch is that there are things that are not digitized that are in each of our local historical societies, or in some cases in the Library of Congress or in archives, you know, across the sea. But the only way to incorporate that into your understanding is to go and look at it, photograph it, understand what the 18th century handwriting is trying to say, and then put it in context. So that old school sleuthing skill is still needed, but it's not how you do the entire amount of the research anymore. You go as far as you can the first way.
No, it's up to us, because
that's right.
Like, you know, we're one of the last generations that can read cursive.
You're right.
And the last of the generations that understand what is an F to us today was an S.
That's right.
Those little simple things are what we're trying to pass down to the next generations. And will we capture them? I don't know. I kind of doubt it in some degree. But you're right. I think historical societies are going to need a little bit of help to have the right individuals in place to basically scan some very fragile documents. And is that possible? In some instances, no. So yeah,
you're right. And right now we're in the cycle of the 250th of the American Revolution. Next year will be that anniversary of the battles of Lexington and Concord. We've been going through the sort of decade that preceded it, and there's lots of stories from 1774, right, that should be told here. I live in Canaan. Canaan had a liberty pole that went up in the end of August 1774. that was 78 feet tall. Think about that. It's a whole pine tree. What was on it? A 15-foot scarlet flag with white letters on it that said Liberty and Property. Why did it go up? Went up because Massachusetts had just had the Port of Boston closed and had just had its charter revoked, and that threatened everybody. Because if they could do it to Massachusetts, they could do it to Connecticut. And then who owns your house? How do you go down to a court where the people appointed to the court are not your people and have any security? That's what changed things. That's why Kanan threw up the poll. And then they went up to Great Barrington and dragged a judge from up there down here and made him recant for not closing the Court of Common Pleas in another state. I mean, those kinds of stories, these are connected landscapes, and they're connected to a much, much bigger timeline. And some of those stories exist, you know, in tiny little articles or in tiny little corners of historical societies and kind of need to be animated now.
In a tiny little radio program called Old Stories, New Information. So that's why we're here. And Tim, once again, it's always a pleasure to have you on.
Oh, thank you. And again, follow up on the information that you have seen in your community that interests you. See where it leads. Question your assumptions. There's a lot more out there.
There is. So until next time, be well and always do right. This will gratify some people and astonish the rest. Enjoy your week.
Old Stories, New Information with Brent Colley is produced at the studios of WHDD 91.9 FM, RobinHoodRadio.com, Sharon, Connecticut.